Chapter 9 of What Befell Julianus, the Emperor's Uncle, and Felix. Julianus forthwith fell sick of a painful disease, his entrails rotted away, and he was no longer able to discharge his excrements through the normal organs of excretion. 3. But his polluted mouth, at the instant of his blasphemy, became the organ for their emission. His wife, it is said, was a woman of conspicuous faith, and he thus addressed her spouse, "Husband, you ought to bless our Savior Christ, for showing you through your castigation his peculiar power, for you would never have known who it is who is being attacked by you if with his wonted long-suffering he had refrained from visiting you with these heaven-sent plagues." Then by these words and the heavy weight of his woes the wretched man perceived the cause of his disease, and besought the emperor to restore the church to those who had been deprived of it. He could not, however, gain his petition, and so ended his days. Felix, too, was himself suddenly struck down by a heaven-sent scourge, and kept vomiting blood from his mouth, all day and all night, for all the vessels of his body poured their convergent streams to this one organ. So when all his blood was shed he died, and was delivered to eternal death. Such were the penalties inflicted on these men for their wickedness. Chapter 10 of the Son of the Priest. A young man who was a priest's son, and brought up in impiety, about this time went over to the true religion, for a lady remarkable for her devotion, and admitted to the order of deaconesses, 1. Was an intimate friend of his mother. When he came to visit her with his mother, while yet a tiny lad, she used to welcome him with affection, and urge him to the true religion. On the death of his mother the young man used to visit her, and enjoyed the advantage of her wonted teaching. Deeply impressed by her counsels, he inquired of his teacher by what means he might both escape the superstition of his father, and have part and lot in the truth which she preached. She replied that he must flee from his father, and honor rather the creator both of his father and himself, that he must seek some other city, wherein he might lie hid, and escape the violence of the impious emperor, and she promised to manage this for him. "Then," said the young man, "henceforward I shall come, and commit my soul to you." Not many days afterwards Julian came to Daphne, to celebrate a public feast. With him came the young man's father, both as a priest, and as accustomed to attend the emperor, and with their father came the young man, and his brother, being appointed to the service of the temple, and charged with the duty of ceremonially sprinkling the imperial viands. It is the custom for the festival of Daphne to last for 7 clays. On the first day the young man stood by the emperor's couch, and according to the prescribed usage aspersed the meats, and thoroughly polluted them. Then at full speed he ran to Antioch, 1, and making his way to that admirable lady, "I am come," said he, "to you, and I have kept my promise. Do you look to the salvation of each and fulfill your pledge?" At once she arose, and conducted the young man to Meletius the man of God, who ordered him to remain for a while upstairs in the inn. His father, after wandering about all over Daphne in search of the boy, then returned to the city, and explored the streets and lanes, turning his eyes in all directions, and longing to light upon his lad. At length he arrived at the place where the divine Meletius had his hostelry, and looking up he saw his son peeping through the lattice. He ran up, drew him along, got him down, and carried him off home. Then he first laid on him many stripes, then applied hot spits to his feet and hands and back, then shut him up in his bedroom, bolted the door on the outside, and returned to Daphne. So I myself have heard the man himself narrate in his old age. And he added further that he was inspired and filled with divine grace, and broke in pieces all his father's idols, and made mockery of their helplessness. Afterwards, when he bethought him of what I had done, he feared his father's return, and besought his master Christ to nod approval of his deeds, to break the bolts, and open the doors. "For it is for thy sake," said he, "that I have thus suffered and thus acted." Even as I thus spoke, he told me, out fell tile bolts and open flew the doors, and back I ran to my instructress. She dressed me up in women's garments, and took me with her in her covered carriage back to the divine Meletius. He handed me over to the Bishop of Jerusalem, at that time Cyril, and we started by night for Palestine. After the death of Julian, this young man led his father also into the way of truth. This act he told me with the rest. So in this fashion these men were guided to the knowledge of God, and were made partakers of salvation. Chapter 11. Of the Holy Martyrs Juventinus and Maximinus. Now Julian, with less restraint, or shall I say, less shame, began to arm himself against true religion, wearing indeed a mask of moderation, but all the while preparing gins and traps which caught all who were deceived by them in the destruction of iniquity. He began by polluting with foul sacrifices the wells in the city, and in Daphne, that every man who used the fountain might be partaker of abomination. Then he thoroughly polluted the things exposed in the forum, for bread and meat and fruit and vegetables, and every kind of food were aspersed. When those who were called by the Savior's name saw what was done, they groaned, and bewailed, and expressed their abomination. Nevertheless they partook, for they remembered the apostolic law, everything that is sold in the shambles eat, asking no question for conscience' sake. 1. Two officers, in the army, who were shield-bearers, in the imperial suite, at a certain banquet lamented in somewhat warm language the abomination of what was being done, and employed the admirable language of the glorious youths at Babylon. Thou hast given us over to an impious prince, an apostate beyond all the nations on the earth. 2. 1. Of the guests gave information of this, and the emperor arrested these right worthy men, and endeavored to ascertain by questioning them what was the language they had used. They accepted the imperial inquiry as an opportunity for open speech, and with noble enthusiasm replied, "Sir, we were brought up in true religion, we were obedient to most excellent laws, the laws of Constantine, and of his sons. Now we see the world full of pollution, meats and drinks alike defiled with abominable sacrifices, and we lament, we bewail these things at home. And now before thy face we express our grief, for this is the one thing in thy reign which we take ill." No sooner did he, whom sympathetic courtiers called most mild and most philosophic, hear these words, than he took off his mask of moderation, and exposed the countenance of impiety. He ordered cruel and painful scourgings to be inflicted on them, and deprived them of their lives, or shall we not rather say freed them from that sorrowful time, and gave them crowns of victory? He pretended indeed that punishment was inflicted upon them not for the true religion for sake of which they were really slain, but because of their insolence, for he gave out that he had punished them for insulting the emperor, and ordered this report to be published abroad, ascribing to these champions of the truth the name and honor or martyrs. The name of one was Juventinus, of the other Maximinus. The city of Antioch honored them as defenders of true religion, and deposited them in a magnificent tomb, and up to this day they are honored by a yearly festival. 1. Other men in public office, and of distinction, used similar boldness of speech, and won, like crowns of martyrdom. Chapter 12. Of Valentinianus the Great Emperor. Valentinianus, too, who shortly afterwards became emperor, was at that time a tribune, and commanded the hostati quartered in the palace. He made no secret of his zeal for the true religion. On one occasion when the infatuated emperor was going in solemn procession into the sacred enclosure of the Temple of Fortune, on either side of the gate stood the temple servants purifying, as they supposed, all who were coming in, with their sprinkling whisks. As Valentinianus walked before the emperor, he noticed that a drop had fallen on his own cloak, and gave the attendant a blow with his fist, "For," said he, "I am not purified, but defiled." For this deed he went to empires. On seeing what had happened, Julian the Accursed sent him to a fortress in the desert, and ordered him there to remain, but after the lapse of a year and a few months he received the empire, as a reward of his confession of the faith, for not only in the life that is to come does the just judge honor them that care for holy things, but sometimes even here below he bestows recompense for good deeds. Confirming the hope of guerdons yet to be received by what he gives in abundance now. But the tyrant devised another contrivance against the truth, for when according to ancient custom he had taken his seat upon the imperial throne, to distribute gold among the ranks of his soldiery. Contrary to custom, he had an altar full of hot coals introduced, and incense put upon a table, and ordered each man who was to receive the gold first to throw incense on the altar, and then to take the gold from his own right hand. The majority were wholly unaware of the trap thus laid, but those who were forewarned feigned illness, and so escaped this cruel snare. Others in their eagerness for the money made light of their salvation, while another group abandoned their faith through cowardice. Chapter 13 of Other Confessors. After this fatal distribution of money, some of the recipients were feasting together at an entertainment. One of them who had taken the cup in his hand did not drink, before making on it the sign of salvation. One of the guests found fault with him for this, and said that it was quite inconsistent with what had just taken place. "What," said he, "have I done that is inconsistent?" Whereupon he was reminded of the altar, and the incense, and of his denial of the faith, for these things are all contrary to the Christian profession. When they heard this, the greater number of the feasters moaned, and bewailed themselves, and tore out handfuls of hair from their heads. They rose from the banquet, and ran through the forum exclaiming that they were Christians, that they had been tricked by the emperor's contrivances, that they retracted their apostasy, and were ready to try to undo the defeat which had befallen them unwittingly. With these exclamations they ran to the palace, loudly inveighing against the wiles of the tyrant, and imploring that they might be committed to the flames, in order that, as they had been befouled by fire they might be made clean. All these utterances drove the villain out of his senses, and on the impulse of the moment he ordered them to be beheaded. But as they were being conducted without the city, the mass of the people started to follow them, wondering at their fortitude, and glorying in their boldness for the truth. When they had reached the spot where it was usual to execute criminals, the eldest of them besought the executioner that he would first cut off the head of the youngest, that he might not be unmanned by beholding the slaughter of the rest. No sooner had he knelt down upon the ground, and the headsman bared his sword, than a pranaman announcing a reprieve, and while yet afar off shouting out to stop the execution. Then the youngest soldier was distressed at his release from death. Said he, "Romanus," his name was Romanus, "was not worthy of being called Christ's martyr." What influenced the vile trickster in stopping the execution was his envy. He grudged the champions of the faith their glory. Their sentence was commuted to relegation beyond the city walls, and to the remotest regions of the empire. Chapter 14 of Artemius the Duke. 1. Of Publia the Deaconess, and her divine boldness. Artemius, too, commanded the troops in Egypt. He had obtained this command in the time of Constantine, and had destroyed most of the idols. For this reason Julian not only confiscated his property, but ordered his decapitation. These and like these were the deeds of the man whom the impious describe as the mildest and least passionate of men. I will now include in my history the noble story of a right excellent woman, for even women, armed with divine zeal, despise the mad fury of Julian. In those days there was a woman named Publia, of high reputation, and illustrious for deeds of virtue. For a short time she wore the yoke of marriage, and had offered its most goodly fruit to God, for from this fair soil sprang John, who for a long time was chief presbyter at Antioch, and was often elected to the apostolic see, but from time to time declined the dignity. She maintained a company of virgins vowed to virginity for life, and spent her time in praising God, who had made and saved her. One day the emperor was passing by, and, as they esteemed the destroyer an object of contempt and derision, they struck up all the louder music, chiefly chanting those psalms which mock the helplessness of idols, and saying in the words of David, "The idols of the nations are of silver and gold, the work of men's hands." 3. And after describing their insensibility, they added, "Like them be they that make them, and all those that trust in them." 4. Julian heard them, and was very angry, and told them to hold their peace while he was passing by. She did not, however, pay the least attention to his orders, but put still greater energy into their chant, and when the emperor passed by again told them to strike up, "Let God arise, and let his enemies be scattered." 1. On this Julian in wrath ordered the choir mistress to be brought before him, and, though he saw that respect was due to her old age, he neither compassionated her gray hairs, nor respected her high character, but told some of his escort to box both her ears, and by their violence to make her cheeks red. She however took the outrage for honor, and returned home, where, as was her wont, she kept up her attack upon him with her spiritual songs, too, just as the composer and teacher of the song laid the wicked spirit that vexed Saul. Chapter 15 Of the Jews, of their attempt at building, and of the heavens and plagues that befell them. Julian, who had made his soul a home of destroying demons, went his corybantic way, ever raging against true religion. He accordingly now armed the Jews to against the believers in Christ. He began by inquiring of some whom he got together why, though their law imposed on them the duty of sacrifices, they offered none. On their reply that their worship was limited to one particular spot, this enemy of God immediately gave directions for the re-erection of the destroyed temple, 3, supposing in his vanity that he could falsify the prediction of the Lord, of which, in reality, he exhibited the truth, 4. The Jews heard his words with delight, and made known his orders to their countrymen throughout the world. They came with haste from all directions, contributing alike money and enthusiasm for the work, and the emperor made all the provisions he could, less from the pride of munificence, than from hostility to the truth. He dispatched also as governor a fit man, to carry out his impious orders. It is said, that they made mattocks, shovels, and baskets of silver. When they had begun to dig and to carry out the earth, a vast multitude of them went on with the work all day, but by night the earth which had been carried away shifted back from the ravine of its own accord. They destroyed moreover the remains of the former construction, with the intention of building everything up afresh, but when they had got together thousands of bushels of chalk and lime, of a sudden a violent gale blew, and storms, tempests, and whirlwinds scattered everything far and wide. They still went on in their madness, nor were they brought to their senses by the divine long-suffering. Then first came a great earthquake, fit to strike terror into the hearts of men quite ignorant of God's dealings, and, when still they were not awed, fire running from the excavated foundations burnt up most of the diggers, and put the rest to flight. Moreover, when a large number of men were sleeping at night in an adjacent building, it suddenly fell down, roof and all, and crushed the whole of them. On that night and also on the following night the sign of the cross of salvation was seen brightly shining in the sky, and the very garments of the Jews were filled with crosses, not bright but black. 1. When God's enemies saw these things, in terror at the heaven-sent plagues they fled, and made their way home, confessing the Godhead of him who had been crucified by their fathers. Julian heard of these events, for they were repeated by every one. But like Pharaoh he hardened his heart, too. Chapter 16 Of the Expedition Against the Persians. No sooner had the Persians heard of the death of Constantius, than they took heart, proclaimed war, and marched over the frontier of the Roman Empire. Julian therefore determined to muster his forces, though they were a host, without a god, to guard them. First he sent to Delphi, to Delos, and to Dodona, and to the other oracles, 1, and inquired of the seers, if he should march. They bade him march and promised him victory. One of these oracles I subjoin in proof of their falsehood. It was as follows. Now we gods all started to get trophies of victory by the river Beast, and of them I Ares, bold raiser of the din of war, will be leader too. Let them that style the Pythian a god wise in word and prince of the Muses ridicule the absurdity of the utterance. I who have found out its falsehood will rather pity him who was cheated by it. The oracle called the Tigris Beast, because the river and the animal bear the same name. Rising in the mountains of Armenia, and flowing through Assyria, it discharges itself into the Persian Gulf. Beguiled by these oracles, the unhappy man indulged in dreams of victory, and after fighting with the Persians had visions of a campaign against the Galileans, for so he called the Christians, thinking thus to bring discredit on them. But, man of education as he was, he ought to have bethought him that no mischief is done to reputation by change of name, for even had Socrates been called Croesus and Pythagoras Phalaris, they would have incurred no disgrace from the change of name, nor yet would Nireus, if he had been named Thersites, 1, have lost the comeliness with which nature had gifted him. Julian had learned about these things, but laid none of them to heart, and supposed that he could wrong us by using an inappropriate title. He believed the lies of the oracles, and threatened to set up in our churches the statue of the goddess of lust. Chapter 17. Of the boldness of speech of the Decurion of Berea. 2. After starting with these threats, he was put down by one single Beroean. Illustrious as this man was from the fact of his holding the chief place among the magistrates, he was made yet more illustrious by his zeal. On seeing his son falling into the prevailing paganism, he drove him from his home, and publicly renounced him. The youth made his way to the emperor in the near neighborhood of the city, and informed him both of his own views, and of his father's sentence. The emperor bade him make his mind easy, and promised to reconcile his father to him. When he reached Berea, he invited the men of office, and of high position to a banquet. Among them was the young suppliant's father, and both father and son were ordered to take their places on the imperial couch. In the middle of the entertainment, Julian said to the father, "It does not seem to me to be right to force a mind otherwise inclined, and having no wish to shift its allegiance. Your son does not wish to follow your doctrines. Do not force him. Even I, though I am easily able to compel you, do not try to force you to follow mine." Then the father, moved by his faith in divine truth, to sharpen the debate, exclaimed, "Sir," said he, "are you speaking of this wretch, whom God hates, 1, and who has preferred lies to truth?" Once more Julian put on the mask of mildness, and said, "Cease, fellow, from reviling," and then, turning his face to the youth, "I," said he, "will have care for you, since I have not been able to persuade your father. To do so, I mention this circumstance with the distinct wish to point out not only this worthy man's admirable boldness, but that very many persons despise Julian's sway." Chapter 18. Of the prediction of the pedagogue. Another instance is that of an excellent man at Antioch, entrusted with the charge of young lads, who was better educated than is usually the case with pedagogues, too, and was the intimate friend of the chief teacher of that period, Libanius, the far-famed sophist. Now Libanius, 3, was a heathen expecting victory, and bearing in mind the threats of Julian, so one day, in ridicule of our belief, he said to the pedagogue, "What is the carpenter's son about now?" Filled with divine grace, he foretold what was shortly to come to pass. "Sophist," said he, "the creator of all things, whom you in derision call carpenter's son, is making a coffin for." After a few days the death of the wretch was announced. He was carried out lying in his coffin. The vaunt of his threats was proved vain, and God was glorified, 1.